Okay, we are going to get started. We're running short of members, but we're going to get going here. Our agenda today is basically to hear from the boards who are covered by the special revenue fund, and then perhaps if we have time, we're also going to look at some of the other boards. We'll see. If you don't get that done today, we'll do that tomorrow. I'll call the meeting to order. We do not yet have a quorum, and we'll just start without a quorum. I believe on our agenda, the first person who's going to be giving us kind of overview of the Minnesota Health Boards is Cody Weiberg. And so introduce yourself, please. Welcome to the committee, each of you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. Presenting the overview here, I am also the chair of the Health Licensing Board's Policy Committee, which is why I'm giving that overview for you. I have with me Ms. Julie Vangsness, who is in our Administrative Services Unit for the boards and who works on fiscal matters with us in case you have any questions for her. Minnesota's Health Licensing Boards consist of 18 boards. We are separate independent agencies. 15 of the boards are health licensing boards that are funded almost entirely out of fees. Three of the boards are funded differently. Two of them, barbers and cosmetology boards, work with us. They participate in the joint arrangements that we have to share services, but they are technically not health licensing boards. The Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, obviously they license healthcare professionals, but they are funded out of the general fund, whereas all of the remaining boards are funded, as I mentioned, almost entirely out of the fees that we collect. The health licensing boards, in addition to licensing, which of course the name implies that we license, we certainly do that. We license the individuals and businesses in some cases that provide healthcare services to Minnesotans. But we do more than that. We set standards for practice. We investigate complaints that we receive. When it's appropriate, we take disciplinary action. Some of us, with other agencies in the state on a variety of health-related issues. For example, as a pharmacist and the executive director of the pharmacy board, I participated in some committees that health put together to respond to the H1N1 pan flu epidemic. As I mentioned, most of the boards get most of their funding from fees. The way that the process works is every year the legislature sets our spending limit, and if we happen to collect funds above and beyond those spending limits, those go into a special reserve fund that the original intent for those funds was to handle unexpected disciplinary cases. So if a board had budgeted for a certain number of disciplinary cases of a certain level of complexity and either had more cases than was budgeted for or a particularly complex case that perhaps went to the Office of Administrative Hearings and to the courts, the funds could tap into those reserves to fund some of those activities. Over the last half dozen years, as the state has faced a series of budget issues, some of the money from the reserve funds has been transferred to the general fund, either to help balance the budget or to fund programs in other agencies. And again, if you're interested, other boards can tell you how they've transferred money. The Board of Pharmacy transferred $400,000 to the Health Department a few years back to fund a rural pharmacy preservation grant program. The other thing that I'm charged with talking to you about right now is just in general how the budgeting process worked this year. Some but not all of the boards did submit requests to Management Budget in the Governor's Office for special funding for special initiatives. And again, they can explain those to you if they have those. The Board of Pharmacy did not have special requests at this point. But we were also approximately two, perhaps 3 months ago, given direction, like I think most state agencies were, to participate in a exercise by which, in our cases, most of the boards would would come up with 3% cuts in each of the fiscal years, fiscal year 2010 and fiscal year 2011. The boards did all do that. We submitted those to management and budget. Rather late in the process, we also submitted a request to management and budget, and ultimately the governor, that we be considered core public safety agencies, which would not be subject to the 3% cuts. We recognize we did that pretty late in the process, maybe too late for management and budget to fully consider that. We do think that our primary role is public safety. We exist to protect the public, not the professions that we regulate. Be that the case, what came out in the governor's budget, as you will see, is in fact the 3% cuts that we worked on and presented to the governor's office were what was included in the governor's budget. That will have varying impacts on the various boards depending on what their priorities are and where they can make cuts in the budget. So I think that's a general summary of what we do. Just to recap, we're independent state agencies. We work together. We think we're a model of efficiency, quite frankly. We jointly fund the administrative services unit that Ms. Bangsness works in. There are a half dozen staff there that work on human resources issues, budgeting, purchasing, contracting, and IT, so we don't all have to hire staff to do that. And again, we're pretty small agencies. Most of us get our money entirely from fees, not from the general fund. Since I am here, I'm going to go ahead and be the first board to talk about my individual board, the Board of Pharmacy.
That's great. Thank you.
Yep. And then the other executive directors will be coming up here to present their budgets. In essence, again, the 3% cuts that we were asked to make, if you were to look at some of the documents that we've passed around, the agency impact would appear in the case of the Board of Pharmacy to come from, in fiscal year 2010, overtime pay, supplies, and equipment. In reality, though, it's really from staffing, and that's because at the very beginning of this fiscal year, last July, one of my pharmacy inspectors retired, and guessing, as it turns out correctly, that the state would be faced with the budget problems and that we would be asked to make cuts, I elected not to replace that inspector that retired, and the funds for that position were redistributed into other line items as placeholders, basically, because I knew we'd have to make, I was almost certain we'd have to make cuts. So the reality is, the cuts for us really come from staffing in both years. We believe that we will have to cut an additional position next fiscal year. That will be for an office and administrative specialist senior. And so we will be moving from, we currently have 11.4 FTEs, and we will be reducing that by an additional FTE. However, when you factor in the cost of unemployment and insurance and things you have to cover when you lay somebody off, it's really the equivalent of covering 1.25 FTEs next fiscal year. In addition to that, I should note that currently the 1.3 of my FTEs are currently funded out of a federal grant that expires at the end of the year. The legislature directed the Board of Pharmacy to establish a controlled substance prescription monitoring program, but we have yet to receive permanent state funding for that. If we don't receive funding for that, then in fact that program will have to shut down and I'll lose another 1.3 FTEs as well. And with that, I would stand for questions either about generally about the health licensing boards or about the Board of Pharmacy.
Questions from committee members? Lynn Lane.
Okay. I understand that the money comes from fees from the licensees, and it's to operate the board, and anything that you're not allocated to spend by the state, and that year goes into a separate fund. So now the state, by saying take a cut, is basically saying spend less so more will go in this fund so we can take it. Is this...
Madam Chair, Representative, it's a little bit different this year. In the past, there have been transfers from the reserve funds. This year, actually, the transfers come directly from our operating budget to the general fund before they go into the reserves.
So fees from licensees become taxes?
Madam Chair, Representative, the part of the fees that we collect will go into the general fund under the governor's proposal.
I think one of the things that this committee really wants to hear, too, is like, what is it that will be lost in terms of service to, for example, in your case, pharmacists? And you mentioned there will be less inspections. There will be, could you just reiterate again just the things that you will not be able to do? It sounds like you're losing federal funding, or that's coming to an end. And if that was a cushion, it's no longer going to be there, I guess. And so what is it that will be missing to the citizens?
Well, Madam Chair, that's going to vary from board to board. But for the Board of Pharmacy, the legislature and the governor's office did give us permission in 2007 to expend more funds to hire another inspector. And the case that we made then is that we were starting to get a backlog of inspections because the number of facilities that we licensed has increased dramatically over the last decade, but the number of inspectors remained the same. So, in effect, having not replaced the inspector in anticipation of these budget cuts, I'm back. My board is back to where it was in before 2007 in the number of inspectors we have. I would expect, even though we have tried to create efficiencies, and we have created efficiencies to an extent, I do think that there will be a longer period of time in between inspections of the facilities that we license. That will be the primary impact. In regards to the federal funding, again, it's a little bit of a separate issue because this is an entirely new program we were asked to develop. That the first phase of that was just implemented in January. It'll be fully implemented by April. The federal funding, we actually were able to leverage the federal funding through the end of fiscal year 2011 by signing an extended contract with the vendor. But after that point, if there's not permanent state funding found, the session law actually says the Board of Pharmacy does not have to run the program if there's not adequate non-state funding. And so at that point, the board would really have no choice but to eliminate that program and lay off the people that we've hired to work on that program, because right now we're just spending federal money to run it.
And if I understand correctly, Mr. Cody, that program dealt with prescription drug abuse. Is that what you were talking about?
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's what it does is controlled substances are drugs that are commonly abused. And the ones that we're focusing on here are ones that can also be prescribed. We're not looking at heroin and things like that. Most of the controlled substance prescriptions that are dispensed to residents of the state are reported on a daily basis to our database system. That's the part that's happening right now. Pharmacies are reporting to us right now. By April, physicians and other prescribers and pharmacies will be able to securely access that data if they think someone is doctor shopping, if they think they're going from doctor to doctor and getting prescription after prescription and then going to multiple pharmacies to have them filled. They will be able to look at the database and either confirm their suspicions that the person is doctor shopping or find out, no, that they really aren't. And that's what the system does.
So, Mr. Cody, without that resource, how will this sort of effort go forward, or will it just be dropped?
Without securing sufficient state funding, it will have to be dropped. We are applying for an additional federal grant. However, only 25% of that can be used for operation of the system. The rest has to be used for enhancements. That would not be enough to run the program.
Okay, thank you. And just one other final question, unless any other members have questions. You said that there are more facilities that you're inspecting. What kind of additional facilities are we talking about here? More pharmacies? What are the facilities?
Madam Chair, yes, there are more pharmacies. There are issues with rural pharmacies, independent rural pharmacies closing, but the chain pharmacies are constantly opening up new stores, either in the Twin City metropolitan area or larger population centers, St. Cloud, Rochester, even Wilmer, and places like that. In addition, controlled substance researchers. We have many more of those than we used to have.
Controlled substance
researchers.
Researchers.
Yeah. They have to be registered by the board in order to be able to possess and buy controlled substances to conduct research. Most of those are at Mayo and the University of Minnesota at this point.
All right. Thank you. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much for your testimony. And if you just hang around, we might have to come back to you. Okay, I think the next person then was the behavioral health, Carrie. Rich Seigal, I believe. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
I think you gave us a handout that people can look at, too.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Rexigal, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. And I believe it will be helpful if I provide some context and background so you can understand the present status of my small board. Mm-hmm. The BBHT was created in 2003, and we regulate professional counselors, clinical counselors, and alcohol and drug counselors. Professional counselors are master's level mental health counselors employed in a variety of settings who provide mental health counseling services to adults, families, and children in Minnesota. Alcohol and drug counselors provide addiction counseling services to persons relative to the abuse of and or dependency on alcohol and other drugs. And similar to the other licensing boards, the BBHT is funded through fees paid by our applicants and licensees. Our base budgets are very small, $144,000 for the professional counselors and $250,000 for the alcohol and drug counselors. The lion's share goes to salaries, office space, office supplies and equipment. And my board has struggled with program debt and inadequate staffing since the beginning. So for the adversity is no stranger to us. On July 1st, 2005, our board began regulating alcohol and drug counselors. And this program was transferred from the Department of Health. And with it came $1 million debt. And so there's a surcharge in place of $99 on every initial application and renewal to recover this debt. And at the end of 2008, we had retired half the debt. And we are on target to retire the debt by 2013. I don't know what else to say. In 2007, our staff went from 5 to 3. Base budget was cut by 41.5%. Licensure fees were increased that year, and some new fees were created. And unfortunately, our licensees pay some of the highest fees in the country for their license types. Our professional counselors have an annual renewal fee of $250. Alcohol and drug counselors pay $295. Every 2 years, plus the $99 surcharge, for a total of $394. Then in 2008, as you heard from Mr. Weiberg, in previous years, funds have been transferred from that special revenue fund to the general fund to fund other programs. And in 2008, $3.2 million was transferred from the special revenue fund, and my board's share was $90,000, which represented 22.8%. of the budget. And all I can say is this kind of loss is really crippling to a small board with major program debt. And so now in 2010 and 2011, we've been asked to identify 3% cuts, about 8,000 for the rest of this year and 12,000 next year. And I guess the good news is I've been able to identify areas to cut without cutting staff. We kind of went through that. We took our hit in 2007. And I can say it's kind of a painful place to work sometimes. It's a good place to work because of the variety of tasks, but we receive complaints on a weekly basis about our slow response time to citizens, to our applicants. The fact of the matter is we're not effectively regulating right now, and this just compounds the problems that we already have. So I guess what I would like to see, I realize there's nothing you can do this year, but in the future, I would hope that we could work together so that special revenue fund money paid through fees is used for that and not used to fund other programs. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the members? Representative Seabrook.
Whoa! Oh. Structural failure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And ma'am, could you tell us a little bit about the $1 million debt that you incurred when you took on this department from the Department of Health?
Madam Chair, Representative
Severson.
Thank you. Yes, in 2005, the Alcohol and Drug Counseling Program was transferred from the Department of Health to our board, and with it came $1 million debt. It's my understanding that debt was largely due to rulemaking costs and also because of far fewer licensees than were anticipated to attain that license. In fact, we have about 2,000 alcohol and drug counselors right now. I think original predictions were that there might be as many as 5,000 to 6,000 in Minnesota. And, you know, that's basically the cause. And at least in the case of this board, no startup funds were provided. There was spending authority. And then licensing boards are required in a five-year period to collect fees sufficient to cover their expenses. And so when the Department of Health saw that that wasn't going to happen, that was the source, that was the beginning of the surcharge, $99 for 10 years to retire that debt.
Representative Severson? Okay. All right. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. I'm sorry, which?
Kerry Rexical.
Ms. Rexical, I guess I have a couple of questions. In the governor's budget, there is a 5% across-the-board cut to the consolidated treatment fund. So maybe if I can get a sense of how you think that that might impact the amount of folks that you are going to license or that you may lose if they don't have a job. And then I have a follow-up question. There seems to be a proposal, and I think it might be with some advocates, and I'm just starting to hear about it, that there may be a shift in terms of who gets grandfathered in as it relates to And I may not have this quite right, so if you can help me in terms of who has kind of a two-year diploma that is working on their four-year degree in order to be a chemical health counselor versus, that whole path. And if you can explain that, I don't know it as well. But I guess where I'm going with the question is, do you look to the future based on cuts and maybe changes, potential changes in the way people get licensed to be chemical health counselors, do you think you'll see a decrease in terms of the amount of folks that belong to your that are coming to get licenses?
Ms. Jessica.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden. First I'll address the consolidated treatment fund reduction. I really don't have any information about that because it's not in our regulatory function. However, any time there's a reduction in funds for employment, that's going to have an effect on the workforce. As to the second question, the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy this year does have a bill that's being jacketed right now that will recodify the regulations for alcohol and drug counselors, remove obsolete language, clean up the processes so they more closely resemble that of other licensing boards. And we've worked on that bill for about a year or more, and we've involved an advisory committee persons in the field, educators, professional association, et cetera. And in that process, the professional association, MARCH, in conjunction with the board, looked at the standards, the educational standards to practice. And they determined that if you're going to practice in Minnesota, whether it be with a permit or a license, the baseline degree of preparation is a bachelor's degree. In the last couple of months, we've received some feedback from the two-year programs and some of the students in those programs that, you know, should that go through this year, that change is too sudden, and it's going to prevent some of the current students from entering the workforce. And so we are working right now in compromise language to remove that degree requirement for the permit and extend it out to July 1st, 2015, so that people can make adjustments. But the profession has spoken, and the baseline is going to be a bachelor's degree. So it's my understanding also that there's a shortage of providers, and employers, you know, can't wait for these students to finish their education and get to the workforce. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you very much. That answered my question. Thank you, Madam
Chair. One quick question. What is an example of the kind of complaint that you would be getting that will not be being addressed? I see there's quite a bit of language here about not being able to do investigations. What would be a type of complaint from someone who said, we need you to investigate this situation and you can't do it?
Madam Chair, of course, we will continue to investigate the most serious kinds of complaints. That would be sexual or financial exploitation, you know, of clients. You know, some of the more minor boundary violations, record keeping, minor competence type things that really should be addressed by the board by having a person come in for an educational or disciplinary conference. You know, we're going to have to triage those and really take care of only the most serious complaints.
And will there be an impact in terms of waiting for the licensure?
Madam Chair, right now,
Ms. Mitchell.
Pardon me, I'm sorry.
I'm just wondering if you could just tell me what that might be, if you anticipate that the waiting period will be extended or not.
Yes, Madam Chair. You know, right now, we do the very best we can to move applications along. But if we experience, when we experience this cut and any future cuts, yes, we are delaying people's entry into the workforce. We simply don't have the resources to, what I would say, you know, I'm disappointed in our customer service. There's not much I can do about it. And so, yes, I mean, I've already heard from people, you know, I didn't get my license in time. I lost a job opportunity. You know, they moved on to somebody else.
Can you just tell me what right now is the delay? It sounds like you're laboring under that. Now, what is the period of delay? Well, waiting period from the time a person is applying.
Yeah, Madam Chair, there are some applications that move really quickly. We can license people in as short a time as a month. If applications, and to compound matters, we have extremely detailed requirements for supervision, and many applications come in that are incorrect. That extends the time to process. We have to contact people, et cetera. So it's going to be, you know, much more time than that.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. If there's no other questions, then I would like to hear from the chiropractic.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. After that will be the dentistry and then dietetics and nutrition. You could just maybe think about getting ready to come on up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Larry Spicer. I'm the executive director of the Board of Chiropractic. And thank you for your invitation to the committee. I would like to kind of preface my remarks or somewhat try to set the stage here a little bit by adding a couple of other pieces of information. And that is, as a general matter, a couple of things. First of all, our board, and I believe most of the other boards as well, have had their appropriations either held stable or reduced through budget cuts for 5 out of the last 6 budget cycles. Might even be 6 out of the last 7 budget cycles, I'm not sure. But it's been significant for a considerable period of time. Secondly, the 3% budget cut by itself should not be considered in a vacuum. It's not just the fact that we have to reduce our dollar amount that we're spending, but we have to reduce that in the face of other costs, significant costs rising on us. And so the net effect is potentially higher than the 3%. For example, we're seeing costs in attorney general's fees. We're seeing costs increase at the Office of Administrative Hearings. we're seeing costs in our own rent and supplies and things like that. So we're paying more money, and we're having to do it with less money, or we're having more charges but less money. So with regard to how the services are affected at my board, the common areas that we see effects are in communications, that is communications with the profession, and I'd like to touch just a bit more on that in a moment, but also with regard to our disciplinary process. As Ms. Rexical pointed out, we are having the same kind of impacts in our experience. And then thirdly, in our IT issues. With regard to the communications, one of the major forms of communications for us with our licensees, of course, is our newsletter. We used to, about 3 or 4 years ago, we used to be able to produce 4 newsletters a year. Now, of course, that does have cost. You've got to print it, you've got to put it together, and then you've got to mail it. There are costs to that. This last year, I was only able to put out 1 newsletter, and this year, I'm looking at how I'm going to put out a newsletter at all. That's how serious it is. And the problem with that is that the newsletter is the device used, or the instrument used, for the purposes of being able to notify our licensees of new rules or things that are going on in the profession, not only locally but on a national basis, that they may want to watch out for, pitfalls that they may want to know about to keep themselves out of trouble. It's also reducing our communications with regard to, it's reducing both our rulemaking efforts and our communications with regard to rulemaking efforts. And an interesting and prime example of that is 2 years ago, the legislature established a new sub-registration for the Board of Chiropractic, and that was the registration of animal chiropractors. One of the requirements of that by this body was that we engage in the rulemaking process. I was not able to get to that rulemaking process as soon as I was supposed to because of budget cuts and constraints that we had. And interestingly enough, I got gently chided by the Office of Administrative Hearings recently for having missed that period of time. We are involved in the rulemaking, but they just noted that in our process we started it significantly later than we were supposed to and was anticipated by the legislative activity. The second area where, and I won't belabor too much because we have had much the same experience as Mrs. Rexigal, and that is, and I think, however, one of the most important areas is with our complaint resolution process. We are every year licensing more doctors of chiropractic, so we are regulating more people, we're regulating more professional firms, we're regulating more of all the different sub-registrations, but by the same token, we have less ability to be able to carry that out, and that by itself will likely result in more complaints. Well, we have to do the same kind of triage experience that Mrs. Rexigal does, and that means that some complaints that we would have been able to pay more attention to a few years ago, we're not able to give the same kind of attention to now. And the public is beginning to react to this. I am beginning to get phone calls from the public wondering what's happening with this complaint. Why aren't we doing more? And some of the complaints are very, very serious complaints. Of course, they go to the top of the totem pole when we're triaging these complaints. But there are other lesser complaints that we just have less ability to pay attention to. And so they get extended out. But that also puts the licensee in the position of not knowing what's happening with the complaint that they have been the subject of. So in cases where I might have been able to resolve a complaint in a couple of months, now the complaints are extending out 5, 6, 8, 10 months, sometimes even more, and the licensee is calling up going, what's going on? What's going on? And we're saying we're unfortunately having to focus our attention on other complaints and not being able to get to those as quickly as we would. The third thing I would like to speak to just very quickly, of course, is the IT area. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the legislature established the the regulation of animal chiropractors, and to date, and that, this was 2 years ago, I should have been able to get some IT help to be able to get into my licensing system and make a modification system to be able to enter these people into our database, and allow them the same privilege as all of our other licensees, which is to be able to renew these things online. We're now 2 years into the process, and I am manually entering these people. They're not entered into our online database, so they're not actually in our licensing system, and so their licensing is purely paper, and they're not able to renew their licenses online. And in addition to that, of course, we've not been able to acquire the funds necessary. Well, I'd probably just leave that. Anyway, I think that's probably the substance of what I have to offer, and I would be glad to stand for any questions by the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from committee members? Do you, I have one question. Are you at a point where you're feeling like the public safety is being threatened? Would you say that, or are you not quite there yet?
Absolutely.
You are?
I do believe that, yes.
Let me not put words in your mouth. Would you say what you
were... I would say the public safety is definitely being compromised because of what's happening with our complaint resolution process and the fact that we are having to defer certain types of cases for longer periods of time and in some cases not even be able to handle them at all.
Okay. All right, thank you. Oh, Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just had a question. With regard to the IT comments... and not being able to get some of the new folks online, whose IT department are you? Is that the department's IT department? What IT are you talking about?
Well,
who's letting it down?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Saylor. We have to get a private contractor to be able to come in and make changes in our database to be able to accept the information coming in from a new registration, and we simply have not been able to do that to this point.
Madam Chair, and why? Because you don't have the money, or because you can't find somebody to do it? What's the barrier to getting this IT problem ironed out?
Well, we had two barriers. In all fairness, the first one was when we were first making overtures to some IT people, we weren't going to be able to get it for the price that we wanted. When we finally found a person that could do it and we sole sourced this person, then in this particular case it was personal illness and the fact that he came back to us and said, the funds that you do have available are just not enough to cover the cost it's going to take for me to accomplish this task.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just Mr. Spice, just potential suggestion. I know you said that you reduced your number of mailings to your people out there. Monetary systems. I know the email is a wonderful resource, and you could probably implement that with zero cost, and the return receipt is also an option there. But I understand your plight. I think the whole issue with the animal chiropractic was, I believe, went through this committee as well, as I recall, and it was kind of one of those mandates that we put on, and it's unfortunate to hear that the admin support. Now, do you get some of your admin support from the Department of Administration, or none of that IT goes through them at all? Madam Chair, is a question.
Dr. Spicer.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Severson, I'm not sure if I fully understand your question. I don't think we get any support from admin on that subject at all.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, may I just add one more thing?
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you. Representative Severson, to speak to your previous point, for that very reason, we are engaged now in a project of trying to update all of the email addresses of all of the doctors. Interestingly enough, we currently have about 2,700 licensees. In doing a database search, we have determined that we have roughly 350 licensees that do not have email addresses in our database. We have been on an aggressive project to try to get all those people to put email addresses in so we can do exactly what you suggest. However, I will tell you that does take time because it takes staff time. It takes mailings to get out to those people that haven't given us those addresses. However, we have been doing it. I would also add that even that won't be a perfect system because there is still today a small population of people that just don't do anything online. And they tell us straight out, I don't have an email address. I don't want email But that is a small population, but it is there nonetheless.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Dentistry, Dr. Marshall Schrag. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you. I'm Marshall Schrag. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. Just by way of background, the Board of Dentistry regulates over 16,000 dental professionals, dental hygienists, dental therapists, dental assistants, as well as dentists. And as I understand the baseline, what you want from us this morning is to understand how the proposed cuts would impact our board operations and public safety. I do want to draw your attention to the over the fiscal year 10 and 11, the 3% cuts that are being proposed are $52,000 for our organization, our agency, and our agency also in the budget cycle had been given a $10,000 cut in our base funding, so that compounds the problems. As the others have said, we've already faced many years of budget reductions and are really providing our core business at a very bare bones level. There aren't extravagances in any of the board operations that we have or the other boards that you'll hear from today. In addition to regulating over 16,000 dental professionals, the additional pressures on us with increased numbers of complaints and the complexity of those complaints does draw resources from us, as well as Dr. Spicer had indicated, the cost of rent and the cost of other services that each of the boards is responsible for in order to provide its services. One concern that I have as an executive director of an agency, and essentially I look at this as a small business that we operate, these budget cuts are being asked of us 3% across the board without recognition of the opportunity to potentially increase revenues. And my sense in running a business is that if you have budget issues, you look at what you can cut but also what you can raise. And in fact, our board does have opportunities to raise additional resources and is currently doing so, but cannot access those resources in order to meet our needs. One example of that has come up recently is that in the last session, we changed our regulation of dental assistance from being registered to being licensed. And this was a professional change that was appropriate and necessary to make. What's happened, though, is that with our dental assistants now applying for the actual license certificate itself, they're providing us they're submitting a $20 fee for that, and so we're taking in approximately $9,000 a month for those licenses, and yet we don't have the appropriations available to us to actually be able to go out and purchase the documents in order to purchase those and then mail them out. Money's coming in, it's going into the special revenue fund. We can't access it for the services and the purposes that we need. Specifically, delays and other issues that we anticipate as a result, issuing licenses, as you've heard, there will be delays in issuing licenses. We currently have significant issues in access to dental services throughout the state. With cutbacks in staff and redirecting the core business functions, it will be necessary for us to delay our processing of applications from new professionals. With regard to complaint resolution, we take pride in being able to investigate and pursue and remediate every complaint that comes in. And it is necessary for us to prioritize the types of complaints, and there will definitely be delays in our processing and responding to complaints as they come in. Professional development is another piece that's significant. All of the boards will tell you our major responsibility is licensure, to make sure that the people who are licensed are competent to practice. And so we do that initially at the time of initial licensure, but then we also look at continuing education or professional development to make sure that people maintain their competence throughout their careers. We use an audit system to audit professional development portfolios. We will need to decrease the number or the percentage of audits that we do, and our concern of that is that it will potentially permit licensees who are out of compliance to continue to renew their licenses without our ability to oversee that. Communications and access to board staff, just general business operations. We also take pride in being able to answer the phone directly, to have a receptionist that's available for people who are coming into the office. We are definitely moving in the direction with additional cuts that we will not no longer have that access available, and there will be delays in communicating with our staff. We're down literally to paper clips and pencils, to counting those and to looking for those. Last Halloween, I trick-or-treated for office supplies, and I was quite successful in getting a number of paper clips and post-it notes. But seriously, we are down to looking at dollars and not and just to put things in context. We're small agencies; these may seem like small cuts, but they have big impacts. And one other thing is just board participation. We have board representatives who are appointed by the governor and are from all different areas of the state. One particular board member that we have from International Falls, any board member coming from that distance, we're going to be paying transportation costs and housing and food costs for them to participate in meetings. And we have to look at how many meetings we have, cutting back on those, and the participation of members from across the state. So it's a significant impact. The question you had earlier, Madam Chair, was, is public safety affected? And I also believe that, yes, public safety is affected and is at risk. And with that, I conclude my comments, and I'll stand for questions.
I'm just wondering if you could expand on that last comment. What are the types of public safety issues that you think would be a problem? You mentioned that you will probably have people who are out of compliance with the dental regulations who will continue to be licensed. Is that
That's correct.
What are we talking about? What's an example of what you're talking
well,
about?
Well, a specific example of that would be somebody who does not maintain the number of hours of continuing education that they're required to. And that is really our monitor, our way of determining whether somebody continues to be involved in the field and understanding new technologies, new techniques, and new practice standards. So without our ability to audit as many licensees, there will be many more that fit through that fall through the cracks. And I think the more people that actually get audited, the more the message gets out to the others that that this is something that that the board is serious about, and so that will be reduced.
Just have one other question. You know, so the public calls up and they have a serious complaint, and there's no, you can't get to them. What do you advise, or do you even get to talk to them about that?
Well, at this point, we do triage every complaint call that comes in and determine if you know the emergency, the urgency of the complaint, and our ability to pursue investigation of that. What I had suggested is that people will not necessarily be able to contact an individual immediately, and so there will be a process for those complaints coming in to be reviewed, but it will not be as immediate and as personal as it might otherwise be.
And I guess just one question. I know I think I talked with another board who said what they end up doing is advising people to call the Attorney General. Is that something in your mind that you might have to ask people to?
I'm not sure, Madam Chair, that resolves anything. Mm-hmm. The individuals who are making complaints against health professionals could file those complaints with the Attorney General's office, but the Attorney General's office turns those then over to us.
I see.
So it's it comes back to us eventually. And
okay. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to the point of the audits, I wanted
Mr. Schrag. I wanted to ask you, if they do the audits and they're found in noncompliance, then do you have the ability to levy a fine for noncompliance?
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, that is something that we would like to be able to do. Unfortunately, the way that it's established is any fines that our board would levy would have to be done as a disciplinary action, which would require a disciplinary process. Typically, those kind of noncompliance issues with the continuing education don't rise to that level, and so we don't have the system in place yet to levy fines for those types of violations unless it's accompanied by other violations that rise to a level of disciplinary action.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess one of the other questions I had here was Mr. Scraggs talked about the monies that were appropriated but not able to be expended. Perhaps our fiscal analyst could kind of, do you have any idea of why that might be? I mean, have we put a block in those appropriations and their expenditures of those funds?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Severson, and you may be able to speak to this more eloquently, but if the boards all require legislative authority to either change the fees and also legislative authority to access additional revenues that have been raised. Is that right?
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Severson.
Thank you. And to that point, then, if you have some recommended language that, you know, that we could bring forward that would give you some more of that flexibility, I'm sure, Madam Chair, we'd be open to some of those fixes to help you kind of regulate your own industry.
So, Representative Severson, I think I hear you saying that you'd be, tell me if I'm correct, that you're inviting the witness and perhaps others to come in with legislation that which would raise their fees to their clients, and then it would be our opportunity or responsibility to tell them that they could actually use those dollars, otherwise they would not be able to use them. So it would require some language that you're suggesting we could put into our bill. We do have a committee bill that'll be coming forward. Is that what you're suggesting?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, I didn't mean to say raise fees. I just meant to, if there are fees that are being appropriated that they are not able to access, having language that would clarify their ability to access those fees so that they can properly administer their own program, I think would be, I'm seeing a lot of nodding heads, I think would be beneficial to all our departments. If we put barriers in there that keep them from being able to utilize the funding, I think we need to remove those barriers.
Mr. Schrag?
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, I appreciate hearing that from you. Just to clarify one thing is that the revenues and funds that are appropriated by the legislature are fees that are revenues that we can access and utilize. It's the revenues that we generate that haven't been directly appropriated by the legislature that go into our the special revenue fund as reserve are the ones that that we don't have the ability to access, and those are the ones that historically have been swept away into the general fund.
Representative Severson, if you're interested, maybe you were, I don't know if you were in the beginning, but they were talking about the fact that these special revenues have been used to fill the budget holes in the past, and that's something the administration has done. So if we tried to help you keep those fees for the purpose that they were originally collected, I think that's what you're suggesting.
Madam Chair, we've had this same discussion a little bit in terms of special revenue funds and public safety as well, where there are revenues that are generated and then they are kind of swept up when we have a budget deficit. And I think the intent of much of the legislation is if there are funds generated that it goes to the individuals that are benefiting from the actual services that are rendered, and I would hope that we could do some policy changes that would enact that type of allow them to kind of bear the fruit of their own labor more than just have an appropriation that's regulated by the state, and we're all over the map on that. Give them a little more control over their destiny. So I would certainly entertain that from any of the departments that are bringing their forward their cause here.
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, thank you very much.
And I would just encourage people, that's kind of a request I think that you just mentioned, what we would like to see all people, all of the different boards probably let it supply to the committee. And I guess it would be helpful to know what the license fee is in each of those cases, too, what it already is, and what the
I believe that you have a handout that indicates what license is that? Indicated in there, license fees?
I don't think so.
There is something that actually just that itemizes when the license fees were last adjusted for each of the boards.
Yeah,
and just
true.
You know, historically, for our board in 1999, the board was directed to decrease fees, and decreased fees in 1999, and has not adjusted those since. We're looking at the very real possibility of having to increase fees in the next biennium, but we've been able to hold those down since that time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next person is, I believe, from Dietetics and Nutrition, and then after that, Emergency Medical Regulatory Services. Let me just indicate to our witnesses, we're a little bit short on time. This has been very important, and we're glad to take the time. If there are things that are redundant with the previous testimony, we're starting to see some patterns, you can mention that, and then maybe we'll try to see if we can move forward. But we do want to get this testimony on record. It's really important, especially since we're talking about public safety issues here. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Mickelson, I believe, right?
My name is Lori Mickelson. I'm the executive director for the Board of Dietetics and Nutrition Practice, and I'm also the director for the Board of Optometry. So I will speak to both of those that wants to move the process along, if you don't mind.
Great. Thank you.
In both cases, these are small licensing boards in regards to the number of licensees, approximately 1,100 in each of the respective boards. The current governor's proposed budget reductions for both my boards are $5,000 respectively to each, $2,000 for the remainder of fiscal year 10 and $3,000 for the fiscal year 11. Currently, these reductions are not having an impact on the boards in relationship to staffing, as it has been mentioned that some of the boards will experience that. However, any future reductions would certainly have an impact on staffing. So we are looking to the future regarding that. Other than what the other executive directors have already presented to you, we have the same issues. Nothing is drastically different amongst the boards, and it's just for the boards that I administer, the reductions are just more minimal than the other boards are experiencing.
Ms. Mickelson, can you tell us what the licensing fee is for each of those two professions?
The application fees or the annual renewal, all of those?
Well, I guess
okay.
The person who's paying them is paying them
okay.
both,
for the,
right?
For the Board of Dietetics and Nutrition Practice, the application fee and the initial licensing fee is $250. The current annual renewal fees for those professions is $45. For the Board of Optometry, the application fee is $87. Their annual renewal fee is $105.
Thank you. And is it accurate to say these fees are basically established by the board themselves, who are the professionals from the organizations?
That is correct. In respect to the Board of Dietetics and Nutrition Practice, this is a relatively new board established in 1995. The application and licensing fees were established in 1995. The annual renewal fees in 1995 was established at $150, and through over the course of a number of years, we've been able to reduce that to $45. And this is totally due to the anticipated number of applicants that we determined in 1995 and the actual number who have applied to be licensed. So we were generating more income than we were being appropriated to utilize. So the legislature, prior to the legislature being the determining factor in fee reductions, it was done through the rulemaking process to reduce the fees. But the last reduction was approved by the state legislature. And the Board of Optometry, we have not had any fee changes, either for application fees or renewal fees, for a number of years, basically for the same reason. We were collecting more funds than we were being appropriated, and with each biennial budget preparation, we were asked to reduce our expenses. So we reduce expenses, but we remain with our fees at the same level, generating more money than were appropriated.
Thank you. Do you know, I happen to know what percent, what the dollar amount was that were taken into the general fund then from your excess fees?
This is purely a guess, Madam Chair, but two sweeps ago, it was approximately $30,000 for each of the boards that I administer, and the last one, I believe it was $35,000 to $40,000.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Saylor, did you have a...
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I just have something I would like to say to all of the boards. It kind of came up listening to Marshall Schrag's comments about teleconferencing. I would just like to know what all of the boards are doing with regard to having board members that are, say, in International Falls, you know, because it's one of the costs that you have. Is it a significant part of your budget that, you know, if you're counting paper clips, you're probably counting gasoline, you know, and reimbursement. So I would like to know how much it affects your budgets, you know, with your board members, if you have to consider, you know, having a board member from a long distance away. Do you use teleconferencing? Is that available? Is that a barrier that maybe some of your potential members cannot access it? Is it something that's worth, you know, in considering for saving money within your boards? And the other thing is, if you're not using the teleconferencing, you know, were you actually using a TV screen as opposed to just, you know, the little device in the middle of the room so you can't actually hear what anybody else is saying at the end of the table? I would like to know about the quality issues that you might see for that, and I would like to know if you're going to think that you could save any significant dollars or if it's just a small thing that doesn't count.
Madam Chair, Representative Saylor. For the two boards that I administer, currently we are maintaining our regular schedule of meetings without any concern with it being an impact on our budget. And I believe that we are not allowed to do our meetings by... Okay. I'd like someone else to answer that part about the teleconferencing.
Mr. Code.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Cody Weibert from the Board of Pharmacy. Until recently, actually, I think it would have been, because of the state's public meeting laws, it would have been prohibited to do that. I believe it is now allowed. However, if you choose that option, you also have to make some sort of an electronic link available to members of the public as well. So you have to have a system through which they can also call in, and my board has not done this yet. My understanding is that there is a system to do that. However, I think we may have to pay a fee to use that system to do that.
Thank you very much. It might be interesting to see what the cost of that fee, what that fee is. It might be significantly less than the mileage. Who knows? I mean, that would be an interesting piece of information for us to have, I guess.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's something that we could look into. This, my understanding, this is really new. So I think most of the boards have not had a chance to consider how that would work in yet.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Next, emergency medical regulatory services, Ms. Burke Moore. And after that, we'll be hearing from the Health Professional Services Program, Monica Fieder. Anyway, welcome to the committee. Ms. Burke Moore, is that right?
Yes. Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Burke Moore, and I'm the Executive Director of the EMS Regulatory Board. We regulate, we actually license ambulance services and training programs, and we credential and register EMS personnel from paramedics, EMTs of all levels, and first responders. You may notice, besides the 3% reductions, I also have a budget initiative and correcting an appropriation. And if you don't mind, if I could start with that.
Go right ahead.
You should have. You may have a handout on a change item.
I don't think we do, actually.
$50,000.
Do we have that one? Oh, it's part of the... Oh, okay. It is here. We do have that.
Now, I'll do a quick description of what occurred. Last year, The 2009 Health and Human Services funding bill included a $450,000 general fund appropriation for two EMS-related pilot programs. One went to the Department of Veterans Affairs for a pilot project to transition returning medics to paramedics. That was a $200,000 pilot program. Another $250,000 program went to Department of Public Safety's State Fire Marshal's Office to explore the use of MRUs, which are first responder units, instead of ambulances, to save costs. That $450,000 was to be a general fund appropriation to those two agencies. Unfortunately, the last night of that appropriation bill discussions, the last printing of that bill, a line was cut off of the bill. That line took that pilot program out of the general fund and came underneath my budget. So my budget suffered a $450,000 cut on top of the 5% small agency cut last year. I spoke, as soon as I saw it, which I didn't see until after session was over, I spoke to Representative Huntley and John Walz, and I also spoke with Senator Berglund and the fiscal aides in the Senate to find out, did I miss something? Was that an intention? And it was not. Everybody agreed, but it was a drafting error. As crazy as all those bills get at the end of the year, it just dropped off a page, although there was nothing we could do. So my first, work last year was to figure out how do I survive with a $450,000 cut. There are a number of programs that are funded through the MSRB through grants, so it did not come out of all of my operations budget. Of that, those cuts, the CALS program, which funds training of EMS and actually emergency room personnel throughout the rural areas of St. Paul, of the state, we took $200,000 from that program. Our hope to reinstate all of this. We took money out of the volunteer ambulance training program. How that works is volunteer services will pay for their volunteer personnel, whether it's EMS or EMT or a paramedic, has to go to refresher training. Their volunteers are not being paid. They will pay the cost of that training for their personnel. We will reimburse them for that training. It's so important in the state. So much of our state is serviced by volunteer EMS. And so we need to keep those, retain those volunteers across. So we had to take money out of the volunteer reimbursements. We also took money out of the 8 regional programs and cut out of them. And then in the end, about $150,000 came directly out of my operations. What I did to deal with it in our operations was I had a position that I was going to fill, thought I should wait till we went through session. We left that position open. That was about $75,000. We also did everything we could to find someplace. We sublet space in our office to the new barber board. We gave a cube to ASU, who had another position and didn't have room for them. I held two critical positions open for 3 months before I filled them. This cut ended up being approximately a quarter of my budget, and so I left a quarter of the year, saved a quarter of that salary saving, didn't fill it for 3 months, so I made sure I had enough money to get that position through the year. These were critical positions. One was one of my specialists that do the investigations. Both of them were specialists that did investigations and also did investigations and inspections of ambulance services. They were not open at the same time, however, so there's no time that I've done two specialists, just one. Again, leaving them open 3 months meant that inspections were delayed and investigations were delayed, but that was really the only way that we could do it. Laying off a position, especially at that level, cost me another $38,000 to $40,000, so that gets me nowhere. I don't gain money, I lose additional money when I lay off, so I chose not to lay off. The other thing that we did do is that we do get receipts. Ambulance services buy ambulance service forms. They're called MnSTAR forms to collect data. And we have actually borrowed some of that money to get through this year and have delayed buying new forms because we have enough in stock. So hopefully that will get us through. On top of that, the 5% cut, you know, I got to the point sometimes where we would joke about having bake sales in the lobby or having people with sandwich bars walking up and down University Avenue because we really had not much left. There is a, in the governor's budget is an initiative to restore that $450,000 to our budget. And so that's what you'll see there. As far as implementing the 3% reductions, again, we'll have to go to our other funding programs. We'll need to take another $46,000 out of TALS, the regions, and the volunteer training reimbursements. If you're familiar with the longevity account, also called the Cooper Sams account, this is an incentive program for volunteers to stay on ambulance services, and so many years on services, when they retire, they get a payout. And we did take $18,000 out of that account. Hopefully, it will. It's an account that is actually invested, and hopefully, it can regain that and will not delay or stop anyone from getting their longevity award.
Excuse me, Ms. Brickmore, what was that 18,000 out of what total?
18,000 out of the total for longevity? Oops, I don't know if I got that with you.
Well, percentage-wise, maybe. What are we talking about here?
Actually, it's quite a small percentage. It's $18,000 or $36,000 over the biennium. It's about $700,000.
Thank you.
Now we go back into the EMS RV. All I have left to do right now that I could cut now is staff. Again, I look at my staff, and if I need to cut another $20,000 in 10 and about $36,000 in 11, and I don't have any place else to cut. But again, I look at my staff and don't find layoffs being an option. What I would propose would be to take one position and reduce that position to a 75% time position. That position would still, and I would hope that that person would choose to stay. They would have the option to say, no, lay me off, and then I would have to find another $40,000 for the layoff. In 11, again, I only have people left to cut. I would take two other positions that would go from 100% to 75%. The first position is an IT position. I can get more funding out of that because it's a higher paid position. And the other one would be the person who actually does the credentialing and licensing entry, so it could delay our licensing and the credentialing. The other person would be one of the specialists position that I just filled. Is reduced that to a 75% position. I have eliminated all out-of-state travel. In-state travel, my specialists, my investigators, obviously have to travel. Luckily, I only have one in the Twin Cities. The rest of them are located in home offices across the state, so their travel is within their region, so that does contain that, but we still have to. I've asked them to limit their in-state. I've asked them to not accrue any overtime. Sometimes an investigation or an inspection goes longer than you anticipate. You find more. And at this point, if they have to stay longer, they'll have to cut a couple hours off in the pay period. We do not have funding for overtime at this point. So that could delay another inspection or investigation being pushed off. I do have a couple contracts that would need to be cut 3%. Those are contracts that cannot be severed. Part of it is data storage. I can't have half my data stored. I can't break it someplace else. So that would have to come out of my operations as well. And I have yet to determine exactly where that would come. And I'll stand for questions.
I have just one quick question. We authorized the new Veterans Paramedic Apprenticeship Program last year, right? And did this affect that program at all?
The Veterans Affairs?
The Veterans Paramedic Apprenticeship Program.
Yeah, that is with the Veterans Affairs. That did not, that $200,000 went to them out of my budget. That was okay. Part of the $450,000. So mm-hmm. I have not heard anything about that program, however. It's not important to us.
I see. Okay. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll move along to Monica Feider, is it? Welcome to the committee. And the next person will be the Marriage and Family Therapy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Monica Feider. I am the program manager for the Health Professional Services Program, otherwise known as HPSP. And HPSP is not a health licensing board, but rather a program administered by the health licensing boards. With public safety at its forefront, HPSP was developed to monitor the treatment and continuing care of health professionals who have illnesses that might impact their ability to practice with reasonable skill and safety. We are funded almost entirely by the health licensing boards. 96% of our budget comes from the boards for the monitoring of persons regulated by the boards here today. We also receive 4% from the general fund for the monitoring of persons regulated by the Department of Health and the Emergency Services Regulatory Board. Roughly 90% of our budget is directed towards staff. 5% is directed towards rent, which leaves 5% for all other operations. At the last budget cycle, we had requested base budget increases to maintain our current staffing level. Those were not granted. The 3% reduction that we're required to make compounds, like the other boards had mentioned, the difficulties that we will face. We will need to reduce our staff at least part of a position this fiscal year and additional hours next fiscal year. We've, in terms of how this will impact the services we provide, we receive calls from health professionals wanting to report themselves to our program, for example, for being terminated from work for showing up with alcohol in their breath. We also receive calls from employee health programs, treatment providers, and other people wanting to report health professionals to our program because of illness-related concerns. And without enough staff, we will not have the ability to respond to these reports of professional impairment in a timely manner. How long that will be, I don't know at this point. But when you look at our staff, which is currently, I'm very lucky to have a very dedicated and committed staff, but they are stretched to their limit. And there's only so many hours in a day that they can respond to complaints. So the responding to complaints is one issue. The other issue is reporting people to their licensing boards and monitoring the compliance of our participants. We currently have over 60 more participants in our program than we did at the beginning of the fiscal year. So 626 health professionals are enrolled in our program. We monitor their compliance with treatment by looking at reports from their providers, from their supervisors. We ask for random urine toxicology screens for persons with substance disorders. And the monitoring of the quality of those reports could be impacted as well. So with that, I guess I'd like to address any questions you might have.
Questions from committee members? Do you, so would you concur with some of the other testimony we've had that indicates that we're looking at a public safety issue here with your board?
I believe public safety will be compromised by the not only not allowing us or providing us with a base budget increase, but by the 3% reduction. That will significantly impact our ability to protect the public.
And I think what would be helpful in each of these cases is if you can give us an example. We're kind of running short of time. If you have a quick example, mm-hmm. fine. Otherwise, we could yep. hear that in writing.
If we, for example, if we don't have staff to answer the phone to triage to send calls to case managers, someone calling to report that a licensee was impaired at work wouldn't, that call wouldn't come to us or to us, the correct staff person in a timely manner. one of the things that we often do when people contact our program is ask them to refrain from practice immediately and obtain the whatever type of assessments are deemed appropriate. Without that initial contact right away, we wouldn't be able to ask the person to, you know, refrain from practice and obtain those assessments. So
are you basically talking about a chemical dependency type of issue and someone needing to be referred to treatment and suspending their license, or do you have the authority to do that, or is it just a voluntary?
It's completely voluntary. Mm. 80% of the folks we work with have substance disorders, 50% have psychiatric disorders, and about 10% have other medical disorders such as diabetes, seizure disorders, other things that impact their ability to practice.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, we're over time, and I'm just wondering, would you like us to continue on? Let me just get a sense of who's here. To continue on to hear a few more testifiers, or come back at another time. Pardon me? Yeah. Well, but we need, they all deserve to have their day. Yes.
Madam Chair, I do have a mandate reduction group in here from noon to 1, but we may have completed our work, so unless you see large numbers of people coming in here, I don't really care. If you wish.
Well, I'm wondering, I mean, what we could do is ask the folks that are left on the list to try to come back tomorrow. We do have a committee hearing tomorrow. Would that work for those of you who are here? And if you're not, I think maybe what we might do then is ask those of you to maybe submit something in writing. As Vice Chair said, we have kind of the flavor of what's going on, but there may be specific things that we should hear from individuals, and I don't want to miss that opportunity, especially if we're talking about issues of public safety. So I think since there is another committee coming in, then we will adjourn and ask your indulgence to come back tomorrow. And we have the minutes from the last meeting, which I think Representative Rosenthal would like us to approve. On February 24th. Any discussion on those minutes? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved and adopted. Committee members will meet tomorrow, and we will, if those of you who will be coming back could just visit with us briefly before you leave the room, that would be great. Well, we start again at 10:30 tomorrow, and we have one other item of business. They want to know what. They don't know what time to come.
Green.
So I'm just tomorrow.
No, she didn't say the words. I didn't hear them.
We pretty much finished.
I didn't
know all the list. I made some changes. There's your first mistake.
Committee, I'm going to adjourn this, but let me just tell you, we do have the Department of Health coming in to provide some testimony, and as soon as we're completed with them, I can't exactly tell you how long that'll be, then we'll go to the remaining boards. Committee is adjourned.